Hi, my name is Claudia, and I'm an alcoholic. I also cry. My sobriety date is October 7th, 1990. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other women. I have had a service position since I was 3 months sober. I've lived in 4 states, and the first thing we did when we moved each time was find a fellowship, and I would get a commitment and a sponsor. I also wrote this out because I get easily distracted, go off on tangents, and then forget where I was supposed to be in the first place. So, while thinking about this topic, I started reflecting on different times in my life where I stood at the turning point. Years before I started and found myself at the turning point, like it talks about at the Big Book. I stood at the turning point with a capital T at 6 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, October 7th, 1990, because I had run out of good ideas on how to fix my life. The first thing I did when I had this assignment, by the way, I'm a retired academic, so I have to do research. So I Googled turning point, and I came up with a time. Oh, could I have that, please? Thank you. I Googled turning point and came up with a time at which a decisive change in a situation occurs, especially one with beneficial results. As in, and I like this, this could be the turning point in my life. So let's start back. Early childhood, I'll give you just a brief synopsis. When I was 5, my mom and I and my brother, who was a few months old, went to Chicago to visit my grandparents from L.A., where I was born. And my dad called her and said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't like being a dad or a husband, and I never saw him again. So I'll tell you, I got a lot of mileage out of that. Woo! So I was pretty sure that I had made some decisions when I was 5 that took me until I was... I'm going to say a year after I got sober and I had really done a thorough fourth and fifth step and realized that I had spent a lot of time blaming a lot of other people for my decisions. So I'm going to go forward until I was 15 years old. I suffered from low self-esteem. I had a terrible inferiority complex. We had lived in Chicago, and when I was 12, we moved out to the suburbs, and I never felt like I fit in again. I was a kid in Chicago. We played in the alleys. I had lots of friends. I didn't feel that out of it. I always knew I was different, but I never felt that out of it. But we moved to the suburbs of Chicago, and I didn't feel like I belonged. I rarely kept friends for very long at that point because I always wanted to be part of the cool kids, and no matter what I was part of, it wasn't the cool kids. I think it was Groucho Marx that said, I wouldn't join a country club that would have me as a member. I spent a lot of time alone. I was raised gastronomical Judaism. That is, I didn't know what God was, but I could tell you how to make a good matzo ball and what to eat with what holiday. So I had spent a weekend with a religious group, a youth group I was part of that weekend. We had taken over the temple for the weekend, and I was sleeping in my sleeping bag, and I woke up at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I couldn't find anybody, and I walked in to the rabbi's office, and the door was closed, and I opened it, and there were a group of people and a lot of smoke. And I walked in, and I sat down, and I said, yes, I'd like to try that, please. And I stood at the turning point. Having never experienced that kind of camaraderie and laughter, you know, I found myself in a lot of this when I was writing, thinking about quotes from the Big Book, and I thought, you know, I had a lot of those kinds of standing in the lobby of the Mayfair Hotel experiences, but I went the wrong direction. I saw camaraderie and laughter inside. I was drawn in, and it was the beginning of a new phase in my development. It was years before I really experienced it with alcoholic, but I was on my way. Many crossroads at this time were influenced by the importance of achieving altered states of consciousness. I really only drank once in high school, and I was 16. A bunch of friends had come over, and my parents were out for the evening, and we decided to raid their liquor cabinet. I remember drinking a lot of things with fruit in their names. I remember puking, I don't remember blacking out, and I remember getting up in the morning, everyone was gone, and my mom wanted to know where the hole in the wall in the staircase came from, and to this day I have no idea. But I just wanted to get loaded. That's all I wanted to do. I didn't want to go to school, I didn't want to hang out with anybody who wouldn't get loaded with me. I barely graduated from high school. It affected my relationships. It affected my education. I graduated, I think, with a 1.6 GPA. I had already been accepted to a college. I did go to three colleges. In 2 years, I had five majors. At one point, I majored in parapsychology and theater. Psychology, I don't even remember what the others, but it seemed like every other day. Drinking was added to the mix when I moved out when I was 17. When I'd gone to college, I remember, you know, things like Annie Green Springs and Ripple and Valley High and that kind of stuff we drank in college. I stood at the turning point, seeking beneficial results. This is pretty much how I lived my life. It was time to go home, but I stayed for one more. It seemed like a good idea to bring the entire band back to my apartment. I just wanted to party. I just wanted it to last, just one more. My friends were leaving the bar, but I was having fun, and I think he likes me. At 21, Quaaludes led me to the man of my dreams. He let me down several times, and I thought, well, this could be the turning point. I think I'll move to Los Angeles, which I did, and the critical change led me to Jack Daniels and acoustic. I had this image of myself listening to Blinded by the Light with my bottle of Jack Daniels, playing pool in my little apartment in Reseda. Every night, I was the last person to leave the pool room. He, the Quaalude guy, he called me, and that was the turning point. Yay, everything would be better now. I moved back to Chicago. This is my new life. A relationship. I got a new job. Maybe we'll get a house. We'll have kids. We'll have the white picket fence. Everything's going to be wonderful. I went back to school. I got a bachelor's degree. I didn't drink very often. When I did, I just drank too much. But I was on a mission. You know, one of the things I left out was I always visualized myself. I was a person with a weight problem. So my mind said that someday I'm going to be thin enough and I'm going to have enough and I've got this husband, we're going to have kids and the whole thing. I went back to school, didn't drink very much, got married. We bought a house. I had two daughters. We started our own business, and this was going to be the happiest time in my life. And I remember standing in the window of our house in Highland Park, Illinois, with a drink in hand, looking across the street and thinking, you know what would really make me happy? That house. Because there was this hole in me. And the kids and the house and the husband and the whatever I had wasn't enough, and I needed more. And at that point, I was drinking every day. He had mental and emotional problems, and I was drinking. We were quite a pair. I kept thinking if I could fix him and then fix me, everything would be great. The relationship crumbled, and I was a daily drinker. Boy, I was at another turning point. He was institutionalized twice, and we got divorced. A new life, on my own, single mom, two little girls. I had a job, and I had a lot of expectations and a lot of fear, but I was excited, and I drank. And at this point, I am a daily drinker. I moved to a little apartment with my girls. I was on the verge of losing that job. I drank every night and dated quite a few Mr. Right Nows and Mr. Wrongs. I lost that job due to poor performance. Every choice I made was fueled by alcohol and magical thinking. I was still convinced that if I could ever get it to 5'8", I'd be fine. I had to be taller and thinner, and if I had had long blonde hair, and I was pretty sure that if I looked like you and had your life and enough money and Mr. Right, and this was sort of this underlying theme through my whole life. My last drunk was a blackout at a dinner party. A couple weeks before, I had met this really nice guy at a Yom Kippur dance. We were getting ready to go to this dinner party. He was going to come pick me up. I had gone shopping earlier in the day. I had bought a couple bottles because, God forbid, there might not be enough. And I had started drinking in the afternoon, which I did every day. But this time, of course, to go out, I had to get ready to go out because there might not be enough. And bottles in hand, and he had bottles, and we get to this dinner party, and I blacked out some point when I heard somebody say, maybe we should make some grasshoppers. I think that's the last thing I remember that night, and I came out of the blackout the next morning on my living room floor. And I was done. I don't know why. Nobody was on my case. In terms of 12-step programs, what's interesting is I had a big book and a 12 and 12 in my nightstand. I had had one there for several years because, like I said, I thought my problem was I needed to be thin, so I'd gone to another 12-step program, and they had given me a big book and a 12 and 12, and I remember looking at it probably while drinking and thinking, this doesn't apply to me. This isn't my problem, and I had put them in my nightstand. And then I had a friend, Mickey, and she said my problem was all the guys I was dating that had drinking problems. So she had taken me to some Al-Anon meetings, and I still didn't feel like I fit in there because I really identified with the people they were talking about. And, of course, I was dating guys who drank too much because I met them in bars. And then I had this little relationship with this guy who had been a heroin addict, but he still drank, but he went to AA meetings, and he wasn't using his drug of choice, and we would sit and drink, and he would tell me about the last seventh-step retreat he had gone on. So between Crazy Junkie Guy and Cagney and Lacey TV show, I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stood at the turning point. And it was 6 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, October 7th. I'm going to cry. I picked up the phone and I asked for help. I called Alcoholics Anonymous from the Yellow Pages, and this wonderful woman answered, and I said, I'm in trouble and I need help and I don't know what to do. And she said, can you get to this particular meeting, St. Luke's Church in Evanston, Illinois, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon? And it's a pretty good one for people who are new. I said, I can do that. So I got off the phone, and I had to drive 20 miles and pick up my kids from Sunday from their dad's house because he wouldn't take them to Sunday school, another resentment on my list. And so I had to go pick them up and take them to the temple nearby to Sunday school, and there was a religious education program for adults, and I was going to go sit there and get my kids, and then I would take them back and come back and go to the meeting that afternoon. And I went to the religious education room, and it was closed. The guy who ran the program wasn't there that day, and so I didn't know what I was going to do for a couple of hours, and there was another mother there. Needless to say, I was hungover, sick, shaking, and miserable. And she said, "You want to go out for coffee?" And I said, "Yeah." I don't remember her name. And we went out, and to this day, I believe I did the first three steps with a complete stranger in a coffee shop who wasn't an Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I said to her is, "I have a problem with alcohol, and it's affected everything in my life. And I've called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe they have a solution for me, and I'm going to go to a meeting this afternoon and give it a shot." And so I took my kids home, and she told me things about herself, and I don't even remember what they are. But I took my kids and I took them 20 miles back to their dad, and I got home and I took all the bottles that I had in my apartment and I emptied them out. Even the magical, I had this bottle of creme de menthe up on the shelf in the hall just in case. I never opened it, but it was my just in case. And I even got rid of that one and I put it in the recycling bin and I drove about a mile away and switched it for someone else's, because God forbid somebody might know. And I brought back their empty. And at 4 o'clock that afternoon, I showed up at St. Luke's Church in Evanston, Illinois. And I walked in, and they said, "Hi, you want to read this?" And they gave me How It Works. And I was shaking and I was crying, and it was the kind of meeting that if you were brand new, they started over with the first step from the 12 and 12. And all the women in the room passed a newcomer kit around and they all put their names on it. And I stood at that turning point. And I, not being a particularly religious person, but I think I'm a pretty spiritual person, asked for protection and care from this group of drunks with complete abandon. And I read How It Works, and it said, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." And I think I bought that. And things changed. Thank you. It was the real deal. I stayed sober. I have stayed sober since October 7th, 1990 at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I would be remiss if I didn't add the part that 2 weeks later I met Mr. Wright in that room. He had 4.5 months. We've been married 23 and a half years. I worked the steps. I got a sponsor. They asked me to make coffee and clean ashtrays. And at 3 months, they gave me the key to the church and said I could come in and make coffee before the secretary showed up. I found true love, got remarried, pursued and achieved a PhD in marketing. This is over the last years. I'll make this brief. We, 4 days before we got married, the company my husband worked for went out of business, and we stood on the altar of that church in Deerfield, Illinois, and we were both pretty confident that this was going to work out. And we moved to Phoenix when he got a new job, and I went back to school, and we raised 3 teenagers, and I got a master's, and I got a PhD. And we raised awesome children, and I'm going to be a grandma in 2 weeks. And we found the cool people. I found the cool people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I can stand each day at the turning point. We've had lots of them. At one point I was going to give him custody of my kids. I mean, there were times when what we had was really, really hard, and we worked really hard to get through it. But it was because of sponsorship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a higher power of my understanding that I've been able to deal with things great and small and know that I can count on its protection and care. New adventures and challenges will always have me at the crossroads, and today I have the tools to keep me on the path that helps me remain to be of service to others and to my higher power. Thank you.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you, Claudia. You know, one thing that you said that's struck out to me, and I can tell you it doesn't actually work, when you said that you wanted to be, if you could only be tall and have long blonde hair, things would be better. I'm tall, and when I was young, I was tall, I had long blonde hair about halfway down my back, and it still didn't work, and here I am. You know, I love, it's amazing, you know, I mean, in 2007, I was fortunate enough to bring Joe and Charlie to, involved with bringing them here, and I emceed the Joe and Charlie Big Book Study, and there was 800 people there. And so from when I sat down a moment ago, it's filled up here, and big difference between 800 people and 1,000 people, it's just seeing that little bit. But the other thing, I love hearing about people's turning points, and for me, one of the turning points in Sarasota, in Florida, and it was 1988, and I had 5 DUIs. And the fifth one in Florida at the time was automatic jail time for 5 years. And so this one I was going to fight. And even though you already know the results, okay? I get that. But I go to a trial by jury. And it was a 3-day trial by jury. Didn't hit anybody, didn't kill anybody, didn't wreck the car, nothing along those lines. And on the third day, I went into that jury room and I went to the jury box, and there wasn't anybody there. And I was standing at the turning point, and I was agnostic. Other than, you know, my family, we were the kind of family that would go and, you know, you take a can of green beans at Thanksgiving to church, and that was the extent of it. And I went over to this jury box, and I was like, if there really is some kind of God up there, please, please, let this jury come back with the right verdict. And they came back with a guilty verdict. And for those of you who have been to jail, they come right up and handcuff you and off you go. So, but anyway, thank you. Thank you, Claudia. Our next speaker here, this is his first international convention. He comes from Massachusetts. You know, and of course, I just beat all these people right here. But with that, we'll give you Paul.
My name's Paul. I'm an alcoholic. It's very nice to be here. It's an honor to be asked to share here, and it's just by circumstance. They needed speakers, and somebody sent me an email, and I got the call. So it's an honor to be able to be here. I want to thank the convention committee that's put this on. This is so well run. I wander around the city. I see the green shirts everywhere. They're directing me where I need to be. It's fantastic. Last night's meeting, you know, will be something, an experience that I will remember for the rest of my life. That was really something special. But I got sober on November 18th, 1990. We're kind of in the same class. I was 20 years old. I was in college in upstate New York. I was a freshman in college in upstate New York. And if you do the math, I was a 20-year-old freshman in college. Which meant I was a 20-year-old senior in high school. But I just wanted, you know, I just wanted to be normal. I just wanted my life to progress. Like, that was what I had been chasing my whole life, was that things were just, the ship was going to right. Things were going to get better, you know. A lot of my turning points growing up and, you know, before I reached the turning point, I mean, that they weren't necessarily conscious reaching out to God. They were built out of geographic cures and running from situations and trying to manipulate people and change my situation, change my circumstances. You know, I kept thinking if I change the circumstances, you know, but the problem was, and you guys know, like I brought me everywhere I went, you know, and nothing ever changed. And it didn't change a whole lot even before I picked up a drink. You know, I was a liar, a thief, and a cheat before I drank. Never really comfortable in my skin. And you probably wouldn't have known it if you had seen me. But that's the way I felt, you know. And certain survival skills that I learned growing up about manipulation and lying to try to get what I need, those were my survival skills. And then when I picked up a drink, the decisions that I was making were all based on that drink from the go. I was in a lot of emotional turmoil. I mean, there was some stuff going on in my life as far as family stuff that was pretty painful that I was running from. But when I picked up that first drink, there was no turning back. I made decisions based on that drink. I fought for my right to drink right from the get-go. I had a family that was, you know, that loved me and was willing to support me, and I wanted nothing to do with them. You know, I didn't want to be seen with them. I would rather be seen with the guys I was doing drugs with down in the projects than my father, who wanted to drive me to school and support me. I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed by the things my family was trying to provide me with because it didn't fit into the image I was trying to portray. You know, there was a time in my life that I had a warm bed to sleep in, and I was choosing to sleep on a heating grate in Harvard Square in Cambridge. The camaraderie I had with the guys that we were drinking pop-off vodka with, you know, on the heating grate in February. You know, those were the decisions I was making, you know. So I was in upstate New York, and it wasn't it was just a progression of my life falling apart, you know, the progression of those geographic cures. I lived out in Wyoming. I worked on a cattle ranch. I did lots of stuff. You know, for a young guy, I was able to take a lot of different trips to try to change my environment, and it never worked. So failing out of college, 20 years old as a freshman, I reached out for help. And I asked a guy that I was in school with that was sober to take me to a meeting. And last night somebody at the meeting said, "Don't keep coming back, stay." And that's what I did. And the reason I stayed was because you people dragged me. You know, I showed up. I brought myself there. But I was, they call it mocus back home. I don't know what they call it in other parts of the country, but I was a mess. You know, I could not hold a job. I couldn't even hold a conversation. I couldn't look you in the eye. I had zero social skills. The social skills that people learn growing up as an adult, I had none of them. I was full of fear. But the people from Alcoholics Anonymous just took me in. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I belonged somewhere. And I kept coming back, and I was living in Boston, you know, I was from Boston, and I was up in upstate New York, failing out of college, and got sober and stayed in my dorm for a little while and didn't go to class, and eventually just moved back to Boston and joined a home group and did the same thing. I took a job sponging tables after my home group, and I got a resentment if anybody else tried to clean tables because that was the social highlight of my week. Was the interaction that I had. You know, I mean, there's a reason they tell you to get those jobs. You know, they used to call it ashtrays, brooms, and chairs. There's a reason they tell you to get those jobs. A, it's humility, but B, I mean, that was my social interaction. You know, and there were smoking meetings back then, and I'd go outside and I'd smoke, and I wasn't a coffee drinker until then. So I was drinking gallons of coffee, not sleeping, and, you know, not that I slept that great anyway, but it really wasn't helping. But I was going to a lot of AA meetings. You know, in my early recovery, due to the fact that I couldn't stay in school, I couldn't hold a job, I tried working at Stop and Shop, and I cut myself in the deli, and I was telling somebody this before the meeting, they didn't fire me, I just never went back, you know? I didn't tell anybody there I cut myself, and I didn't, you know, let them pick up the medical bills or anything, you know? And I didn't pay the medical bills, and so I had creditors calling, and, you know, it was like early sobriety for probably a lot of people, you know? But I just wasn't drinking, you know? I was not ready to accept a spiritual solution in my life. I was ready to not drink and keep coming, you know. I heard the God thing, but I was neatly evading that, you know. I figured that I could do without, you know, and it was working for a while. Just abstinence and coming to a lot of AA meetings was working. I began to feel a lot better. I began to get a job. I was able to hold a job. I got a job working landscape construction, and I showed up every day. And, you know, I was active in my AA group, and I was going on to commitments. And, you know, there's a friend of mine here in the meeting tonight that's known me since I first came in. And I used to have this little Datsun B210 with a live and let live sticker on the back. And I was probably the first guy to, like, cut you off on the way out of the parking lot. And if people didn't like what I was... If I didn't like what people were doing on the road, I, like, swerved at them in my car. And, you know, I was full of serenity. You know, restless, irritable, content, in sobriety. That's where I was. You know, the subtle insanity that precedes the first drink, I was living it sober. You know, this is all retrospect. I didn't know that. And for anybody else that's newer to AA, this is just my experience, you know. Other people have different experiences. You're going to have your own. But putting the plug in the jug and coming to meetings was saving my life. But I did. I got to the turning point, which it talks about in the book, where I was conscious of the fact of how miserable I was. And I was full of lust. I was full of anger. I don't know how I kept my job. I'm still friends with that boss. It was a long time ago. I haven't worked for him a long time. I see him every now and then. But he wasn't an AA guy or anything. But he owned a somewhat small landscape construction company. And I used to tell that guy how to run his business on a daily basis. The way that he was doing his business aggravated me so much. You know, I got pretty good at working for him and being one of his top right-hand men. But I was convinced if he would run his business the way that I thought he would, his business would be that much better. And I didn't hesitate to tell him regularly. You know, he was a really good guy. But so that's where I was. However many years sober, and a couple of years sober. And the subtle insanity that precedes the first drink was alive and well in my life. That I wasn't going to walk by a liquor store and just be struck drunk. But I was going to get so miserable and so irritable and discontent that a drink was going to look, you know, is going to be an option. And I went to a meeting one night. It was a Big Book Step Study meeting, and there was a dance afterwards. And there was a girl that, you know, I wouldn't say I was trying to have a relationship with her. I mean, that's a lie. You know, I was trying to get with this girl, and that's the only reason I went to that meeting. And I heard somebody talking about their experience with the sex part of the fourth step and their trust in God. And you know, I was absolutely floored by what was going on in that meeting. It was like I'd never heard it before, you know. It was my time to start to digest a spiritual message, you know. And I didn't go to the dance after that meeting. I stayed behind, and I talked to a guy who took the time to spend some time with me and explain to me the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I was reading them in step meetings. I was going to 12 and 12 meetings. I was reading them. I was probably telling you, you know, my experience with the 12 steps. But there was no practical experience with the steps or with any bit of faith in my life at that time. And that guy that took the time to show me the steps, I mean, he didn't make it. That, you know, you stay sober long enough, you see lots of people that have helped you and that had more sobriety when you came in. And, you know, sometimes they go out or they move on. You don't see them. You know what happens. And a lot of them die. You know, and that's been part of my experience, is that I know enough people that have died in Alcoholics Anonymous, people that seemingly had this solution, that for whatever reason, the subtle insanity caught up with them and they made a decision to drink or drug and didn't make it back. But being at that turning point and inviting God, I was told to invite God into my life. That's how I was told at the beginning, and it made perfect sense to me, because the stuff that went on in my life when I was a young kid is I lost my mother to cancer. She had a long battle with cancer and lost her, and I felt God turned his back on me, and I didn't have a relationship with God whatsoever, you know. And at that that time, I was ready. And I reached out. Like, I made the effort. And I invited God into my life. And it was based on action. I was asking God on a regular basis to come into my life, to remove me from the situation and have situations be as he would have them. I got into the steps, you know. We started at the front of the book. I was convinced the fourth step was going to cure me. You know, I had my eyes set on that, that was going to be my solution, you know. And, you know, somebody said it last night, that the solution is in the journey, you know. The joy is in the journey, but also that's where the solution lies for me. And it wasn't just the fourth step. It was starting at the beginning of the book and the preface and going through the doctor's opinion and being at the decision, you know, the step three to turn my life and my will over to the care of God. I did that blindly. It wasn't because I was filled with the sunlight of the Spirit. It was because I knew I needed help. And so that was blind faith that I took my third step on, and I followed it up immediately with action. Is how I was told to do it. And I started in on my fourth step, and, you know, after that novel was finished, you know, I read it to my sponsor, and I moved on. And it was the action, you know, it was the action steps after that have made all the difference in my life, that continue to make all the difference in my life. You know, the information that I saw about myself and the selfishness and the dishonesty and the self-seeking behavior that that is me, you know, and people say it's alcoholic behavior. I really don't know. You know, I think it's human nature, to tell you the truth, you know, but that's just the world according to Paul. And I just think that alcohol, you know, I'm susceptible to alcohol. I do have that allergy. So when that behavior, when I act that way and I get to a point where a drink is an option, all bets are off. But as far as like the emotions that I have and being selfish and self-seeking and afraid, I don't necessarily know if that's just alcoholics. But it definitely was me, and I was seeing it in black and white. And I was seeing how selfishness was at the forefront of all the decisions I was making in my life. You know, whether or not to let somebody cross my path in traffic, you know. And it's a blatant example is if I let somebody cross my path in traffic, and if they don't say thank you, I'm immediately resentful. You know, it wasn't out of the goodness of my heart, you know. It was to get a reaction. And you can put that on every different level, and that's how I was operating in my life, you know. And I had no idea what it was to be truly selfless. And my experience is that without continuing to further this stuff in my life, you know, I'm 24 years sober. I mean, sobriety time is not the solution for me. You know, it's working these principles in this life. It's in my life. It's because my life is a lot different now from that guy that couldn't even get out of high school, that only went to college because he wanted to, thought it was the next step that everybody else was doing. You know, at a certain amount of my sobriety, I went back and I got my bachelor's degree, and I was a union construction worker for 15 years, and I knew that I wanted to work with kids in the high school. And my wife took a position that allowed me to leave that job, go back and get my master's, and now I'm an adjustment counselor in a local high school where I live, you know. And you know, I mean, it truly is a success story, but it's an Alcoholics Anonymous story. You know, that is not possible without faith and action for me, you know. And so I have two young boys. I'm married to a woman I met in this program. There are challenges for me. We all do. We all have them. But I have my own challenges of self every day, you know, based in fear, based in anxiety. And I can choose to trust and rely on Paul or trust and rely on God. And I don't always trust and rely on God, you know, and that's how I know why trust and rely on Paul, like why trust and rely on Paul doesn't work. Because of some of the situations I get myself into, some of the, I have a tendency to put things off, you know. you know, I work in special education, and there's a lot of paperwork and a lot of collaboration with parents and teachers, and you know, I will get full of fear and not take the steps that I'm supposed to take, you know, and. That affects everything. It just snowballs, you know. But the solution is the exact same, in inviting God into my life, you know. because it's not about, if there's anybody new, like, why am I talking, like, it's not about drinking for me anymore. You know, it's about living and trying to further this stuff in my life. You know, I have a healthy respect for alcohol. I worked in a liquor store for 3 years when I was sober. I called my sponsor. The people I was working for needed somebody to that they could trust to work in their liquor store. And I called my sponsor. I think I was like, I don't know, it was maybe 5 years sober. I called my sponsor and I'm like, and he said, that stuff in the bottle is not going to jump out and grab you. You know, it's not about what's in the jug. It's in your head, you know. And I took that job and I worked that job for 3 years and I left that job because it was time to move on. You know, I was moving back to Boston. This was on the South Shore. And it was never an issue, you know, because I was taking care of my, you know, my spiritual nature. I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And to tell you the truth, the liquor store was connected to a bar. So between the drunks coming over to get their bottles and buying scratch tickets and all this stuff, thank you, I was constantly reminded, you know, by the reality of alcoholism. But the way things work in my life today is that this is just a kind of a rejuvenation for me. You know, I've moved out of the Boston area. I live out in Western Massachusetts now, and I've been struggling with a balance of a new job, two small children, a wife that works long hours, and I was so connected to AA in the Boston area for 20 years, and now I'm trying to find a balance all over again in a new area, you know, and I've joined a bunch of different groups, and then for some reason or another, it's not working out with my family situation, but none of that matters, you know. My job is to keep trying to show up at Alcoholics Anonymous and become a member of those groups and be there for the person that walks in the door. My friend Tommy always makes a point to say it, that, like, taking up a seat is sometimes the best service he does. You know, you people coming in here and taking up a seat in this meeting can be some of the best service that you do all day. Coming to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and showing the newcomer that walks in that door that it works because there's 1,000 people in this room. I'm just very glad to be here. I'm humbled to be up here and to be able to share my story with you guys. And thank you.
You know, I appreciate when you said what your sponsor was saying about working in the liquor store, that it's all in your head. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the most important sentences, I believe, is on page 23, and it says, the problem centers in our mind, you know. So I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my program is what got me here. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous works exceptionally well when I work it. I was thinking of, and I love turning points, and I was thinking about, you know, when the jury came back with the incorrect verdict for me down in Sarasota. And so my choice was to go to a 28-day treatment center or go to 5 years in jail. I had to think about that. because if I went to an alcohol and drug treatment center, people might think that I was an alcoholic. So I thought about it, and you know, look, I lived on the Intercoastal Waterway in Florida. Now, granted, it was in a 10-year-old beat-up car that I'd parked there every night, but that's where I told people that I lived, right? And so I thought about it, and my pro bono attorney said, boy, you're real smart, I can tell. So I went to the 28-day treatment program because she told me I could do it standing on my head, and I was like, 28 days, 5 years, okay, fine. And so I go, and that was April 10th of 1989. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you only have one white chip, I'm here to tell you, not from a bragging type of way, one white chip, I know plenty of people that only have one white chip. Again, this thing works if I work it. When I get out of the way, this thing works real well. So thank you, Paul. Our next speaker here, our anchor woman, is from New York, Area 49, I think it is. And So she's been to, she started her first convention in Montreal. So that was, when was that, in 1985? So with that, we shall give you Nellie from New York, Brookman, New York.
My name is Nellie, and I am an alcoholic. A very grateful and honored alcoholic. I thank the convention for allowing me to come and share with you today. I was quite kind of shocked and surprised when I got that email asking me to be on a panel, and the topic is at the turning point. And then I was told by my past delegate, she just rotated out, that she had submitted my name, and also my friend at GSO had sort of okayed it. So here I am, and I listened to the previous speakers, and I thanked them because I heard the word from Paul Mokas. I heard fear. I heard anxiety. And I heard the academics. For me, my sobriety date is March 16th, 1980. And in 1980, they had, the topic was joy of living, and they had that convention in New Orleans that year. And I had wanted to go, but I was too frightened. Too frightened. A friend of mine who we ran around together as beginners in AA, she went to it in 1980, but I made my first one in 1985. But I had many, many turning points in my life and in my life of sobriety. I've been in the program 35 years, and I hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous after my birthday. My birthday's in January, and I had my last drink in March. I hit the program in January 1980 at age 42. And that was many, many years of alcoholic, devastating drinking. I was mocused, spiritually bankrupt. I remember at that time going back, thinking about this is a spiritual program, hearing about that, and thinking about when I was in college, back when there was a beginning turning point of being a frightened freshman in college, of really crossing that line of alcoholism, and that was a long time before I made the program. And I was in a religious college. And they said I was an atheist. Because we had a seminary at the college, and some of my classmates identified me as the atheist. I was told, this is about truth and telling the truth. I was an only child, born in a small Baptist southern town in North Carolina, and sort of kept away from other children. My parents were elderly, and they were frightened that I would turn out the wrong way. So I was programmed to go to Sunday school every Sunday, go to church every Sunday, go to a religious camp in the summer. And then graduated from high school, and I got these applications for college. I didn't fill them out. My mother filled it out, and she filled it out for the Presbyterian College in Charlotte, North Carolina, Johnson C. Smith University. And that was really a turning point, because here was this little lonely child, not knowing how to socialize, and met up with these older guys and these older women, especially the older guys, who had the money to drink. And this was a time when there were a lot of veterans in our school, and so they had a place called the Veterans Grill. And I went there, and looking back, I saw that I drank more than the rest of the people, and drank a lot. And we were drinking pitchers of beer and country club at the time. And so that was a turning point, but it had negative consequences. But really, I graduated from college and don't even remember the graduation. They tell me I did, and I have the diploma. But that senior year was full of blackouts, and later on in the program, I learned what blackouts and grayouts were. I had lots of them, many incidents that were alcohol-related that I had no idea what they were. Such things as when I was around in college and on campus and going to the canteen, falling down the canteen steps, because they had about 5 steps to go down into this area where they sold the things, and I blamed it on my high heels. When I wet on myself, I blamed it on I like tea and tea drinking. Things went on like that, and I took my first major geographic by moving to New York City after college graduation, because I had spent summers in New York City, and I had stayed with an extended family member who was a barmaid. And I could dress up in her clothes and go to the bar and drink. Turning points, but I think about my life as an alcoholic, and maybe you all have had some of the same experiences. I started working for the city of New York, and I gravitated towards the people who maintained lots of alcohol in their house. They had an open bar after work, and I gravitated to going to their house, drinking in the evening, sometimes making it back to work in the morning. But I always went to work. I liked going to work. That was sort of a control. And that's the way life was, going to work, hanging out with my drinking older and always older people who had the money to buy the alcohol. And I worked for the city of New York 35 and a half years, and they never fired me, never brought me in to disciplinary over drinking. One of the turning points I had was... And this was something that introduced me to the idea of AA. A friend of mine back in the 70s said, "Nellie, don't you have a problem with drinking?" And for the first time, I said yes, because in college, I had been brought up to face all my sorority sisters to ask me, did I have a problem with drinking, and was I an alcoholic? And I said, no. No, it was a denial up until that time in the early 70s when I said, yes, I do have a problem, because I was very depressed at that time. I was going to work every day, but very depressed. And she saw this, and she said, well, I have a therapist for you. So I'm very happy that we as carrying the message that we reach out to the professionals, doctors, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, and medical, all the medical and helping professions. We give them literature and let them be able to identify an alcoholic. Well, this particular therapist said, I cannot treat you if you're drinking. So she sent me to a doctor. And Dr. Ruth Fox in New York City at that time, way back in the 70s, was a specialist in the alcoholism field. She put me on antabuse. Okay, antabuse. And she said, you have a therapist, so you don't have to come to me for therapy, but you can come to my psychodrama sessions. There were six of us in these sessions. All of a sudden, I found, after several weeks, I was the only one coming. I said, oh, I've run these people away. That was my ego thinking. Mm. But someone later told me, say, they all got drunk. They all started. But I kept on in therapy. And the antabuse, I only took it a very short time. I remember going to a party where loads of drinking, but I remembered I wasn't supposed to drink. I don't remember drinking, but I do know the next day I was almost dying. I was hanging out of my window. I lived in Harlem at the time, and I was on the fifth floor, and I had all these open windows, and I was dialing the doctor, calling the doctor, calling the doctor. No answer. I survived. I threw the pills away. But it began a period of really utter craziness. I was not drinking. And for 3 years, I did not drink with no program. Don't advise it. I don't advise it. She had mentioned going to AA, but I had said, that's for those Bowery bums. That's not for me. But that's, I said it to myself. I don't know where it came from, where the thought came from, where the idea. But somewhere, I lived in New York City, somewhere I had heard it and knew it. I went through graduate school. This was many years after the BA. Went through graduate school, went to graduate school, and went to therapy 3 times a week. And not drinking, but I saw people that were partying, and I was always one that was fearful, didn't ever learn how to dance. I think the only black person in the world with no rhythm. Can't dance. I can get drunk and I can do something. But that's the way it was. But one of the turning points, one of the things that this therapist, I've seen her years later, and she said, Nellie, I'm sorry about that. She pronounced me a recovered alcoholic, and I was graduating with a master's degree. And she said, you don't have to come to therapy anymore. So I was not in New York City. I was outside of New York City. I came back to New York City, got a very nice apartment on the Lower East Side in Manhattan, and promptly took my checkbook and went around to a liquor store and handed them my check and ordered a case of white imported wine, Spanish wine, I think it was. And started my drinking because I said my problem was I was drinking the scotch, the bourbon, the vodka, Budweiser to cool off the stomach, because I was doing it all, because my favorite was beef eater scotch. And I hung out with the crowd of people who drank scotch all the time and gin, beef eater gin in the summertime. We sort of had a routine about the drinking. And I said, that was my problem. And so I said, I'll try the wine. And I said, I didn't like the smell of the beer. But turning points. It brought me to a devastating bottom. The 3 years of not drinking, 5 years later of drinking, 5 years of drinking and started drinking excessively. It was fine at first. I could go to parties. Then I got thrown out of parties. My friend said, no more. After the incident of my acting out at their houses. And one time, being on the 28th floor of an apartment building, my friend's house, and I made a pass at her brother, and she said, his wife is going to throw you out that window. And she drug me out of the apartment and said, you can't come back. Turning points. But it led to good things because I had to address the loneliness, address all of this drinking, address all of the problems that I had at work. I was a boss over a whole lot of women. And they were always called in the union. And they would say, Miss Purifoy, what's wrong? Why are these women calling me? Why are we having these meetings? I don't know. But I was totally sick. All these character defects were coming out. Okay, how did I get to where I am now? Went to different therapists. And she happened to have a patient that was in the program, a guy who was willing to talk to me. And she and that patient 12-stepped me into the program. And I became a person that was in the program and working and going. Then I retired from work, and people said, you can do more service than at the group level. And I had come to that a point of acceptance that long time ago, my 2.5 years in the program, I came to that point of acceptance and feeling it in my bones, in my heart, that I was an alcoholic. And it was a lifetime job. And then they said, okay, you can do service. You're not working. Became the GSR for the group. Then next thing I knew, I was the DCM. Then the DCMC for Brooklyn. And I always went to all of these conventions, went to the assemblies and all these other AA functions. And I began to become very familiar with the 36 principles. Well, I already knew about the steps and the traditions because we talk about that in the groups. Only recently have they started talking a lot about the concepts. And then when going to, I think in San Diego, it was the first time I'd ever been into a workshop on the concepts. It was one of, I was there because the delegate was from my borough of Brooklyn. So I heard about the concepts then, and then I had to start really becoming familiar with them, giving service with CINI, Southeast New York, and being a trusted servant for my area of Brooklyn and helping out with different areas of service with CINI. And so today I am the CINI liaison to Intergroup. So I had to start learning something new to go to all the intergroups in my area and to hold meetings with them. Some of the things that I have learned is to turn loose the fear, walk through the fear. I've also learned tolerance. I have also learned that I have a right to be wrong and you have a right to be wrong. So, and I'm doing better. So I thank you all, and I thank David. My time has run out, so thanks.
Well, that was just a 2-minute warning.